This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning and welcome. My name's Rochelle Hunt and I'm based in Melbourne.
And I'm Kirsten Diprose coming to you from Warrnambool.
Kirsten, if you had to sit the new Year 12 numeracy and literacy test right now, how do you think you'd go?
Oh, I don't know. I think the numeracy might be a bit shaky. Literacy, I'm hoping I'd be okay. You know, when I got my first job at the ABC as a cadet, I had to do this test and my grammar wasn't okay. And the boss mentioned it to me on my first day. It was terrible.
I remember being chastised from callers and from listeners very early on here doing the traffic about schedule and schedule. So I learnt very, very quickly. But numeracy and literacy, when it comes to jobs, that's certainly changing. And we've just heard in the last week or so that now Year 12s will be tested on their numeracy and literacy. And that test can be accessed by potential future employers. So I'm just wondering, I mean, how many people do you think will ask to see this? And how much of an impact will it have on the jobs that we do or don't get?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's funny because I think every other state actually already does this, and it's caused quite a bit of a storm here in Victoria as the only state that really doesn't. But the fact that these tests results can be accessed by potential employers, that I think is what is so scary to people. But you know, I know of employers who will look at a job application and it could be for a really hands-on kind of a role. And if they see spelling mistakes all over the place, they're making a judgment already. It's hard not to.
But I wonder whether or not it makes somebody the right employee for that job, you know, whether or not numeracy and literacy actually comes into it. I mean, we've all got spell check now, don't we? We can fudge our way through a lot of this stuff. But that's what we're looking at today. Maybe your maths and your reading is terrible. Do you think that that will affect your potential work opportunities? And what makes a good employee? How important is numeracy and literacy? What else should we be teaching? And if you're an employer, would you ask to see these new test results?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria,
this is The Conversation Hour.
Would you look at numeracy and literacy when it comes to maybe giving somebody a job? And has that changed? Is this something, Kirsten, that you think has changed over the years? If I look at, say, oh, not even my generation, but maybe my mum's generation, this was a period where people actually left school at 14, 15 and 16, went on to get jobs, many of which went on to run their own businesses really successfully. But qualifications have changed, haven't they, or what's expected?
Yeah, I think so, because there aren't as many pathways as there once were that are either vocational, and that could be on-the-job training or through TAFE or other kind of organisations that do that sort of specific vocational training. And sometimes there seems to be this push, particularly among schools, to get everyone to university. Now, university is great and you want to encourage your kids to do the best they can, but university is not for everybody and it can't be for everybody. But we've seen this big change in even the way careers are structured. Like, Rochelle, how did you get your job, for example?
By ringing, I'm not joking, I think I rang every radio station in Australia, willing to move. I had done a lot of volunteer work. I worked my way through Radio of Hard Knocks, through volunteer radio, and then literally just rang around until somebody gave me a go. And here at the ABC was not where I was expected to have an opportunity, but I did. And then once I'm in, Kirsten, you can't get rid of me. I just stay. I become like furniture. But then I became like a sponge. What can I learn? Who can I go to? And I worked as hard as I possibly could, asked as many questions as I could, and basically said yes to everything. But I don't know whether it would work like that now.
Yeah, I think you definitely do need that on-the-job training. But in media is a perfect example, or communications as an umbrella job. You are expected these days to have that piece of paper, that degree, and it has become an academic field in its own right of communications, which didn't even exist, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And now, instead of sort of journalism is how I kind of came through into the media. And, you know, people 10 years or 20 years older than me, they got cadetship straight out of school. But that wasn't open to me. I got a cadetship, but it was after uni. And that was what was expected. It's funny how it's changed.
It certainly has. Before we have a chat to a teacher that's thinking really outside the square in Templestowe, let's have a chat to Lorna. She's in Bairnsdale. Hey, Lorna.
Hello there. I'm all for the numeracy and literacy, but I also think two subjects that I don't know, I don't think are being taught in schools yet, but should be, life-saving ones such as first aid, starting in primary school for that one, and for year 12 and 11, I think they should have their driving test. All they need to know about
driver education. That's a really good point because today, thank you, Lorna. Kirsten, we're actually going to be looking at other subjects that maybe we should be teaching beyond numeracy and literacy. Of course, we're not saying that numeracy and literacy aren't important. We never would. But there are other life skills, hands-on skills, skills that would give you a job that maybe we're not teaching at school.
And these are, life-saving skills, first aid and driving. I mean, we know the death rates from driving young people in particular is really high, young men and boys. So is that something? But schools can't deliver everything.
That's right.
Teachers only have a limited amount of time, and I think we put too much pressure on them already to kind of
teach everything
and make these perfect little humans when the biggest teachers of any child's life is going to be the parents.
Tim Sproul is a teacher at Templestowe College and really thinks outside the square when it comes to numeracy and literacy because, Tim, not all of us are naturally good at numeracy and literacy, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we will be bad business people or will be bad employees. How important is numeracy and literacy and making sure that kids finish with a really good grasp of both?
Yeah, it's a good question, Rochelle. What I see in terms of low literacy students, because that's more the field that I work in, I'd say the biggest issue with low literacy students is actually a well-being issue and a sense of self. Taking away the work stuff out of it, these kids have been told their whole life that if they just do this thing or just do this thing, it's all going to come to them, and they just haven't had the success that a lot of people do. And it's not because they're dumb. They do everything they're told and it just still doesn't work. A lot of it's to do with the fact that they're not actually being taught the way that our brains need to learn, or they're not being given the phonics instruction that they really need to be successful in literacy. We have kids at our high school who work at grade 2-3 level sometimes. We are an alternative school, so we have a lot of kids who kind of come through here that haven't had a lot of success in the other systems. And if we give them really good explicit phonics instruction, and we do that multiple times a week, we see really good results straight away. So for me, literacy is, it's such a key part of being in our society. So I think it's really integral that all of our children and our students have a really good grasp of literacy from a primary school level.
Yeah, Tim, what can you do if you encounter, and you obviously do, children who have gone through primary school and they're really not up to the scratch, the level you need them at for high school? How can you bring them up and get them re-engaged, particularly when, you know, I remember learning a lot of Shakespeare in English in high school, and that is not going to match if you haven't got those basics down.
Yeah, of course not. Look, at TC, we kind of take two approaches. One is we have a very explicit intervention program for spelling that we run before school. This year we're doing a reading one as well. It's all scripted. We're just reading from books, and it worked. It's amazing how well it works. But the other thing is I run an English elective called Level Up. It's for disengaged students in terms of English. And what we found that if we remove all those traditional hurdles, the novels, all that sort of stuff, and we just focus on the writing and the mechanics of writing, then these kids actually do quite well. So, for example, Level Up is about computer games. So we tap into that intrinsic knowledge. These kids are all experts in computer games, and they have to write reviews about computer games. We read reviews about computer games. And the real kicker with the subject, the thing that makes it work, is the beginning of every lesson is a very explicit instruction around sentence structures and metalanguage. So we take kids who are some of the lowest performers in English at the school, and by the end of a year or two, these kids can explain to you what subordinate conjunctions are, coordinating conjunctions that can explain where the commas go in a complex sentence that starts with a subordinate clause. So it doesn't matter who the child is. If we use the right sort of instruction, and the cognitive science is really, really clear, how memory works, It doesn't matter who you are. If we do lots of repetition, we check for understanding so we don't automate errors, and we space out exposures to it. I haven't met any kids that can't learn.
Tim, stay with us. Ben's called in from Malvern. Ben, what did you want to say?
Hi. I wanted to say that if I had to take a numeracy test right now, like today, I would be absolutely hopeless. And I have ADHD, and I didn't really learn that I had ADHD until later in life. I'm in my late 20s now. And basically for me, what that means is that it makes the most simple of math problems quite difficult. Like, even if you ask me, you know, what's this plus this, I'd have to do it on my fingers.
And Ben, have you found, I mean, what sort of work do you do now when it comes to numeracy and literacy, and whether or not you feel like it's held you back, or it's put you, it's maybe pointed you in a direction of a particular type of work?
Well, nowadays I'm a courier, so it's not so much of a big deal nowadays, but I have a background in retail, and for the most part in modern retail, it hasn't really been a problem because everything is worked out for you. But on the one or two days where the POS system had gone down, and we had to do everything the old fashioned way, I would have a little moment of panic because it's like, oh my God, how the heck am I going to get through this if I don't have these little, if I don't have
this. It's a really good point, isn't it, Kirsten? Like Ben says there that, you know, we do have all of the technology to help us, but sometimes technology fails.
Yes, and there's also a thing called digital literacy, which we assume young people have, but they may not. Sharon is in Ballarat. Sharon, welcome to the program.
Hi, and lovely to hear you, Kirsten, on the air.
Oh, thanks, Sharon. Nice to hear you.
Yeah, and we love Rochelle. You're so fantastic, Rochelle.
Oh, Sharon, yeah, we love you. What did you want to say?
My degree is in literacy and numeracy, and so I've had decades of a teaching career, mainly contract and emergency. So I see what's happening out in the schools, primary and secondary, and what I'm noticing is that I don't see that the grammar and the mental maths and even the timetables that were supposed to be taught in primary, that those things are readily in the brains of some of the students, because
I think grammar's
you need
a
mental
sticking point, Sharon. I think grammar's a real sticking point in that it hasn't been taught. They ripped that out grammar's not being taught in a way of naming it the way that you learn it in a language. I didn't understand grammar until I started learning French.
Oh, wow, fantastic. And the other thing I wanted to say was when they come out the other end, the students, at SMB, which is part of Federation University, I've voluntarily done this, teaching the students who want to get into, say, nursing or maybe a technical course in higher ed or TAFE, often have to do a numeracy course, and I've actually volunteered in that as well. And my own nephew, who left a very, very well-known private school without not enough numeracy to get into his course, did that very course that I was volunteering in. So they were complaining a while back about the people applying for nursing. You've really got to have good numeracy and good literacy.
Yeah, well, I could imagine that in nursing, absolutely, Sharon, you would have to have good numeracy. And Tim, we'll come back to you now. Tim Sproul is with you. He's a teacher at Templestowe College. How much of it, Tim, depends on working with the student and then maybe having an idea of what they might want to do post-school, and then what skills they're going to need and how they're going to be able to apply both numeracy and literacy to the work that they're going to potentially do?
Yeah, look, I think it definitely plays a role. The great thing about Templestowe College is we offer a really diverse range of options for students. We have animal programs and breeding programs with reptiles and that sort of stuff. So we attract a lot of students that would struggle in a traditional school setting. But none of that, like, it doesn't really matter where you're going. You still need to have that core literacy sort of stuff. And it was really interesting to listen to Ben talk then about numbers. And I think Sharon talked about that automation. Like, I think a lot of our primary schools, it's a case if you don't know what you don't know. I don't think sometimes the leadership don't really have the latest evidence in terms of how our brains work and how we learn. That a lot of people don't really understand cognitive load theory, Sweller's stuff out of the University of New South Wales. Like, we have working memory. We know that we can only hold 4 to 7 items. But we also know our long-term memory is unlimited. And anything that we can automate, then that doesn't count for our 4 to 7 items in our working memory. And it's going to mean that we're not going to overload ourselves. So what I'm hearing with Ben was that he didn't automate his basic number stuff, didn't automate his basic addition, didn't automate his timetables. Same with spelling. If we're not automating our spelling as well, this is why we have these kids who, when they struggle with literacy or numeracy, we start seeing behavior management issues, we start seeing school refusing, because they're just cognitively overloaded from the moment they get to school. And so it literacy is so much more a bigger issue than just the job stuff. It's a whole lifestyle kind of thing that it addresses. Yeah.
Tim, thank you so much. It's been wonderful speaking with you. And I wrote down when you said, I've never met any kids that can't learn. And what a great attitude to hear from you as a teacher at Templestowe College. Tim Sproul there. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And, you know, we can't just, as we mentioned before, leave it up to schools, Rochelle. You know, it's got to go beyond schools. And parents, we need to think beyond schools as well. And our next guest is Gareth Colleton, and he is someone who thinks beyond the traditional education system. He runs a program here in Warrnambool. It's out of the old Fletcher Jones factory, and it's called One Day Studios. And during the school holidays, they were doing lots of different workshops. Coding was one of them, costume design, illustration, virtual reality. And Gareth is an artist by vocation and has run galleries before in the region, and he's a bit of a local entrepreneur in setting up creative and educational spaces. So welcome, Gareth.
Well, thank you. Well, nice introduction.
We're done now. Bye-bye. See you later.
Yeah, exactly.
Gareth, I mean, it's really important, isn't it, to think outside the square when we learn, but all of that can't fall back onto teachers, as Kirsten just said. I guess that's where somebody like yourself may come in, and looking at school holidays. I mean, the fact that it's run out of an old Fletcher Jones factory, which Fletcher Jones is where we used to go get our school uniforms, so there's a lovely little symmetry there. But are children, teenagers coming to you to get that additional stuff that maybe we're not getting at school?
Very much so. I find that we're getting students who aren't getting some of the creative outlets and information that they would like to have in their lives from schools, and the schools are overwhelmed, particularly now more than ever. I echo what Tim sort of spoke about in regards to everyone can learn. We're getting students sort of sent to us who are being labelled as disengaged, and I really don't like that term. I feel like it's the education system that has somehow pulled away from them. Everybody, every student, every young person wants to learn. That's just a given. And if they're retracting out of an education system, then I feel like the education system isn't supplying what it is that they're looking for. And so we try and make a little satellite that can plug into schools, and we provide technical, creative education that can be done after school or during school hours.
Gareth, do you think we as parents or teachers or the older generation have an attitude problem when it comes to things like YouTube and gaming and the stuff that kids these days really want to do?
Absolutely. So I really empathise with young people who are being told to cut out the computer games and get serious about their futures. And I was always told, have something to fall back on. You know, oh, it's great that you're creative, how lovely, but you're going to have to do that on weekends. It's not a real job. My dad would introduce me to his friends as his arty-farty slug of a son. And I think we're still seeing that today. We're seeing students who have got great potential, but we're in zones where adults struggle to see the value. Computer games are kind of the new Gutenberg press. You know, books were very, very frightening when they were first invented, and I think that's where we're at with computer games and technologies.
There would still have to be an element of numeracy and literacy when it comes to taking computer gaming as a serious vocation or coding or whatever it may be. There would be a lot of people that say, well, you need the foundations. You need numeracy and literacy in order to do that. Would you agree with that?
I'm actually reevaluating where I stand on all that right now. Even in this conversation, it's quite challenging what Tim said about making sure that you have this base muscle memory almost of these things. And they certainly come into it. But creativity can actually fill gaps if you do struggle. If you are dyslexic or if you haven't learnt your times tables, you can find creative solutions. So I think, and in fact, the World Economic Forum agrees with this. They've put out reports indicating that creativity is the number one skill for future jobs. People that can adapt and change and learn to fit their new environment as we develop new roles and new jobs, they're the critical skills.
Speaking about the future of jobs and the future of work, no one knows what it's going to look like in 20, 30 years. But I think the future of the entrepreneur seems to be looking pretty strong. And it's not something I certainly wasn't taught it at school. Like, I felt like I was really taught to be an employee of somewhere rather than coming up with my own destiny.
Absolutely. I mean, the Australian Chamber of Commerce, the huge report that they've just recently done, the thing that came out on top in terms of, because it's so hard to run a business in Victoria, was the final crux of their report. It's really one of the hardest places in the country. But what was leading was entrepreneurs and startups. And that's where we were really, really shining. So, yeah, Gareth, I mean, is this something that we do need to take a little more seriously within the school structure?
That's our experience for sure here. So coming out of that 20 years of working as an artist and finding it to be quite a frowned upon career in a lot of cases, it was, you know, a lot of derogatory remarks and expectations that I was on the dole and, you know, whatever else they thought of me. But now we're finding that we creatives are in demand, even from corporations, looking for innovators and creative thinkers, lateral thinkers, and entrepreneurs. So, yeah, absolutely.
I think a lot of people in the content creation space are feeling the same. You know, have always been a writer. I became a journalist and I'm not doing that now, but I'm still doing a lot of content. And there was this big thing, you know, when I was growing up, it's like, oh, what are you going to do? So I became a journalist because it was how you could actually get a job from what you like to do. But now there is just such a demand for anything content that if you love to write, love to create pictures or whatever it is, it's a skill that people want.
But it's also that user-generated skill. And Gareth, this is where I'd be interested to pick your brain in how we think creatively, and that maybe if numeracy and literacy isn't your strongest point, where are your skills and how can you create those opportunities for yourself?
Well, there's so many ways that we can work within a team in these new technologies. So if literacy isn't your strong point, I guarantee you'll have a strong point somewhere else. Our classes here, we do see that where some students feel under-skilled in certain areas. And they feel when they see someone who's excellent at creating an animation or something, they feel a bit down. But we point out to them that they're excellent writers or they've got an incredibly weird brain that can actually think outside the square. And that's a really valuable skill to have in life.
Gareth, thank you so much for joining us. It's been amazing to talk to you and well done in what you're doing in Warrnambool.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a great conversation.
Gareth Colliton there from One Day Studios and local artist and entrepreneur. You know, I think coding, and Gareth touched on this, and some of those more technical skills are more creative than you think. And I look at my own brother who now works for Google in London in the DeepMind section, which if anyone's heard of that, that's where they've got their highest artificial intelligence people. And it's completely changed his life because he started coding as a baby. You know, my mum noticed that he was really into this, invested in a Commodore 64, which was a lot of money and a big call to make when he was 5 or 6, and he started programming and he's made a career out of that.
But see, that career, and we're going to talk about the future of jobs in just a moment with two people that have studied and looked into the future of work. That career, so what department was he in? Did you say the Deep Mind?
It's Deep Mind. It's sort of Google's
deep,
you know, top minds.
I
he can't
that.
Even tell me what he's working on.
Of
he's worked
not.
On in the past. He's worked on satellites that program themselves. So basically, teaching artificial intelligence learning how it, like we learn. You know, when we make a mistake, we go, okay, I won't do that again, and do it a different way. So machines can do that now, and he was part of the team that actually got computers to that stage.
So my brain has just imploded a little bit, but that didn't exist. That job didn't exist possibly even 10 years ago, let alone when we were at school.
No, so he was just playing around, and for the coders out there, they'll know BASIC, which was one of the first computer languages, and he taught me that. and I wish that I had continued coding. I was like, whatever, learnt a bit and went off, and he ended up learning C++ and Java and all the other languages.
Isn't that amazing? What a gig. I mean, someone says, what do you do for a living? I work at Google in the deep mind section. That's someone you're going to chat to in the kitchen. There's texts here, so many. Let's try and get through a few of them. I have a master's in children's librarian and a career in the field, but I would fail a basic numeracy test. And others saying, as a family of dyslexics, I would star in their chosen fields. I find this very unfair. Now, this is in reference to the test, the new Year 12 numeracy and literacy test, and whether or not employers will want to access that, they will be able to, but whether or not they'll look at it and if it will determine the job that you get. Let's have a chat to Jo. She's in Orbost. Hey, Jo.
Good morning. Look, my most important thing for me to, for kids to be taught in school is Auslan.
Yes. It's taught in some schools. It's taught in more schools than I realised, Jo, but you'd like to see it across the board?
It needs to be across the board because then everyone can communicate with everyone.
That's the underlying learning there as well, isn't it? It's about an inclusive society and communication, being open to all. I learnt Auslan in primary school and I'm very thankful I did. I can't remember it very, very well to be able to communicate fluently, but I can still fingerspell and have a basic conversation.
Because I learnt Italian and all I know how to say is Dario non in ritardo, which means Dario is late.
Dario so, sei sempre in ritardo.
I see, we do remember these things.
That's all I remember too.
Pat's in Macrae. Hey, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Numeracy and literacy. How important is it?
Well, thanks for your very positive program to begin with. Now, I had an apprentice that was essentially dyslexic and, you know, had issues with grammar and was okay with maths. But I took him on because he worked for me as a work experience kid. And the work experience program, which is a great way to sort of, see how people, or how kids are going to, enjoy the job that they're intending to do. So I didn't even look at his report.
Oh, that's interesting. So you wouldn't access this test then, the numeracy and literacy test, if you had a job going, you had one, two positions to fill and you had 20 applicants, would you try and narrow that down by looking at the test?
No, probably not, because he's now 45 with kids nearly teenagers. He got Apprentice of the Year in carpentry and building.
Wow.
And so he's very successful at what he did and with his life, because it became his career. And he's a great, great person to work with. Yeah. He stayed with me for 10 years.
I'd love to know, Pat, how did you first meet him? Like, how did you come across him? Was it from a job application or was it because, you knew someone and he was recommended?
Well, essentially it was through the school. So the work experience is, I suppose, an old school type of program where, you get a work experience person for 2 weeks and then you give it a go. And then he became one day a week with me. And he just, I had these preconceived ideas as far as previous apprentices. I wanted somebody who was close to 18 with a license. I wanted somebody that had done year 12. I wanted somebody that, probably had a better report than what Kanan had, and he had none of those, and yet he was one of probably the best apprentice I ever had, and I've had a few.
There you go.
So, a lot of the times it just
takes meeting that person and being able to gauge it on the spot, but then just giving someone a chance, an opportunity. Pat, thank you so much. Let's quickly try and squeeze in Terry. Terry's in Tatura. Hey, Terry.
Hey, Eric.
Good. What do you want to say?
Oh, look, I think sort of things have changed. I'm 72, but I remember in grade 3 that we had 20 spelling every morning and we had to write our name on the board for each time we got something wrong, right, a word wrong. And my name was up there maybe 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 times. So that was a technique used in grade 3 by, I think, Ernie Taylor, right? which I hated, all right? And I'm still not a very good speller today.
That's the thing. It doesn't actually work. I mean, these are the days where you'd probably get then whacked by the blackboard ruler if you got it wrong, or you'd get rapped over the knuckles as well. So, you know, throwing a little bit of violence in doesn't always help. But Kirsten, there's a text here that says schools are not going to keep kids engaged unless they start building in coding and programming into the curriculum, and they need to do that from year seven. In just a moment, we're actually going to look at, well, what is the future of work, but also agriculture and where that should be fitting in to schools and to school programming as well.
Kirsten Diprose here with you from Warrnambool, and Rochelle Hunt, as usual, in Melbourne. On the text line, skills come and go. For instance, I did maths one in HSC in 1984, and I would work and struggle with higher education maths now without a refresher. That's from Anthea. I'd agree with that. I did the higher maths, and I worked so hard to be able to do that. I had to study so hard. It's not my natural ability, and I would not be able to do any of that. Differentiation, you know, I would struggle to do any of that.
I don't even, I can't believe you did higher maths. I am so impressed. You're a real all-rounder, Kirsten Diprose, aren't you?
Oh, I'm not.
You're a high achiever.
It's not true. I sent myself into, I was one of those kids that, you know, my mum used to go, stop studying, it's time to go to bed.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And has that flown through? Like, are your kids showing attributes of that as well?
My eldest is too. He's a bit of a perfectionist, which I want to knock
and
out
cons
of him.
Perfectionism, doesn't it? It really does, because it can really work against you sometimes.
It can lead to anxiety and all that sort of stuff.
Of course it can.
I've had to peel it back and just, you know, let it go. We're all imperfect.
And the future of work, and this is a big part of this conversation, where does numeracy and literacy fall into that? And those jobs, like your brother Kirsten, maybe they don't even exist yet. Well, Professor Russell Tyler is a Professor of Science Education at Deakin University, and Dr. Peter White is a Senior Lecturer in Science and Environmental Education. But together, they co-authored a report on the future of work. A warm welcome to the two of you. Welcome back to the Conversation Hour. The future of work, where does numeracy and literacy come into this? Russell, we'll start with you.
Sure. We did a report on 100 jobs in the future for Ford Australia, and we interviewed about 11, I think, experts from a range of industries to find out where the future was going, and constructed a number of jobs from that. And certainly STEM skills, meaning science, technology, engineering and math skills, were very important within that. But so was the ability to learn, lifelong learning, the ability to work with people, and also data literacy, all of which I think emphasises numeracy skills and also if you think of data literacy and the ability to really be a self-starter in communication literacy skills more generally as well. So, yes.
Yeah, the ability to work with people, I mean, I think we call that sort of soft skills now because we're finding that's more and more important, particularly as we develop this knowledge economy.
I think that's right. I think there's a growing movement within education to really emphasise those generic skills, if you like, of students being able to really reason critically and creatively, to be able to interact with others, to be able to be self-starters in reasoning rather than simply learning procedures, if you like, which is, we were talking about maths before. Often maths was focused on learning procedures, like differentiation, as you say, but how do you use that creatively in an ongoing life and career?
I wouldn't even know how to use it in a straightforward way. Dr. Peter White, I'll put this to you. When we're talking about the Year 12 Numeracy and Literacy Test, whether or not employers will see this as something that they will or will not access, where do standardised tests fall into the future of work and the opportunity of employment, do you think?
Well, it's a good question, and certainly a very topical one. I think standardised tests are a particular tool and strategy that are used by education systems to be able to kind of benchmark, to be able to determine if they're doing the best they can by their young people. And so it's not really designed to be an assessment of an individual's ability in terms of an employment context. So it's a little bit of a mismatched expectation to have a standardised test being a differentiation tool for whether you should employ someone or not. So I guess it's...
Peter, where's it coming? Where's it coming from? Is it the education system that wants it or is required to do this, or is it really driven by parents who really want to know or have some sort of, you know, benchmark? And I know I'm guilty of it. I want to know that at the end of the year, my kid is where they should be in terms of their reading and their maths.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, you want to know that, you know, the school is doing the best they can by your young people, and an employer wants to know that they're about to employ the best candidate that they can for their role. But again, it's just not the right kind of assessment tool that we're using in this context. There are many, many better assessments we could use, you know, like having the CV capture all of our experiences, having an interview, exploring the person's ability to enact in a scenario of the workplace. These are better tools that we have. But the standardized test is an important thing for the system's perspective of education.
There's a text here from Pauline Castlemaine saying, literacy and numeracy are certainly important, but as a primary school visual arts specialist myself, it won't be surprising that I feel arts learning is equally as important, especially in helping aid those with learning difficulties from music to dance. It can actually help those in terms of abstractions and letters and numerals as well. See that it goes on and on and on this particular text. But looking at the role that arts plays, I mean, we've had multiple people now say that arts, we were kind of given a bit of a hard time from our parents. If we wanted to take it seriously, we were saying get a backup job. Is that something that's never really changed, that perception of the arts?
Yes, I would agree. And, you know, the research that came out of the 100 Jobs of the Future report indicated that it's those kind of skills, the ability to communicate with each other, to be empathetic, to understand context and scenarios, they're the skills that we're going to need in our future gig economy, where we really market our individual skills as opposed to embedding ourselves in a career.
Yeah, that's an interesting insight. And we hear some of the sort of big thinkers of our time talking like that. You know, Bill Gates will talk about how the future of work is going to be like that. And you should be investing in yourself rather than your company or your organization, because people are moving around, the world is changing, and you take your skills with you. It's not about the company or the organization, which is probably something that organizations don't want you to say. But it's true. Put yourself first. And your education. Professor Russell Tyler, are you finding that? And I'd be interested, you know, with science education, how has that changed, particularly in this era of miscommunication and people requiring so much more of scientists than, you know, the wonderful work that they actually do?
Yeah, I think that's right. Actually, I'll just go back a step on that 100 jobs. We actually did an analysis of the 100 jobs to see what the role of creativity was in that. And we found, I can't remember the exact figure, it was something like over 80% required some creativity. Not all of them in a traditional arts creativity sense, although there were a number of those. But in terms of engineering design and design elements, that creativity was certainly a very strong focus in all of that. And the other point I was looking to make was that literacy is an interesting thing, because we often think of it narrowly in terms of just written literacy, but certainly within science education we're increasingly realising that literacy involves, you know, being able to interpret diagrams, graphs, and so there's a lot of overlap between literacy and a whole range of skills in particular subjects. It's not just a generic thing in how to pass a sentence. And so I think that's part of the flexibility that Peter was talking about we need in employing people, and not, you know, that standardised tests may not.
And looking at what's on your CV, you know, there was always certain things that in particular my grandparents would tell me was really important to have on my CV. So volunteering, community work, having those aspects of being able to, I guess, essentially care and be involved in your community. And I still, to this day, no matter how far we've progressed and that there are some of the most insane jobs going around, I actually still think that those things would bode well for you on a CV.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if you actually, I'm on the science expert group for the PISA test. That's the test of 15-year-olds, the OECD test internationally. And that science framework, and Peter's involved with that as well from an environmental perspective, in that science framework, we're increasingly looking at decision-making and agency as part of what you want out of an education, which is similar to what you're talking about, people being able to do things and use their knowledge for good rather than simply expressing it on tests.
Yeah, and what's on paper and what's the reality. Mm. It's always fascinating to speak with the two of you, and I know, Peter, you juggled a lot of things around to speak with us today, so thanks so much for joining us.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks, Rochelle. Thanks, Kirsten.
That's Professor Russell Tyler.
Thanks,
thank you. And Dr. Peter White. Together they co-author for Ford, the Future of Work. And it's fascinating, isn't it? And I think that's something, I mean, what a great report to do, because it will continually change and evolve. But what I love out of that is that the foundations of still maybe being involved in your community, volunteering for something locally as well, these are still good things that will get your foot through the door. Because how often, for most of us, all you need is a chance. You just need someone to say, okay, I'll give you a shot. But that's really, really hard to do and to get that opportunity.
Yeah, it really brings forth the importance of networks and networking. And look, some of us are lucky to have, you know, a parent who works in the industry that we want to go in. Like, I always laugh when you see the son or daughter of a celebrity walk into the same industry or get their own fashion designer because their dad was an international, you know,
Beatle. I might just go ask Sir Paul McCartney what he thinks of my idea and see how it goes. Where the rest of us are saying, I don't even know where to start.
But join those organisations, those interest groups. You know, there are a lot of extension kind of or networks for organisations in your industry. Start joining those groups and finding those doors. And all you really need is one person to take you under their wing, a mentor. They might not be the direct employer, but they can put you on to someone. And I also think of that saying by James Clear, who's the author of that bestseller book, Atomic Habits, and it's competence over credentials. And that is what employers are looking for. So competence over credentials, you know, which is not emphasizing all of that experience you come with, but emphasizing the skills that you have to learn, to think laterally, to, you know, be a team player, to have those interpersonal skills. That's actually what will take you further in your career. Once you've got the foot in the door and you've got that basic skill.
Yeah, I believe that 100%. Yeah, I mean, this text here from Rebecca in Heidelberg. As an employer, the school results on somebody's CV is almost the last thing that I look at. Let's have a chat to another Rebecca. She's in Healesville. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you look at on a CV?
Well, I mean, I guess my core was a bit, I find, in terms of standardized testing, I think it's a bit worrying to pigeonhole people for what they did in high school or what they did in year 12. And I think sometimes we need to be a little bit more broad. Like, I'm a mature age student, I'm studying nursing, I'm in my 30s. How I did in numeracy back in year 12 is completely different. Oh, I didn't do actually maths in year 12. I chose not to. So I did it in year 11 and then I quit because I disengaged from maths because I always felt I never could do it. And I always felt I was crap at it and I couldn't do it. So I would disengage. And I was more of a literacy person and a humanities person. So I think life experience and things tackling numeracy now with studying nursing is totally different to how I tackled it when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And that a lot of that comes from experience, life experience, age, having more determination and really wanting something to the point that you push through and you just
I think it's all of those things. I think you've really hit it there, Rebecca. And if we all look back at our 17-year-old self or 16-year-old self, whatever age we are in year 11 and year 12, I mean, seriously, what do we know? I mean, if that's where those decisions are being made, and it's really about having that drive as well, so that you've raised really good points. Thank you so much. Steve's in Yay. Hey, Steve.
Hello. Stephen Townsend speaking.
Hi, Stephen. You're on the air. What did you want to say?
Well, Kirsten, Rochelle, thank you for having this program. It's a very important discussion, and I'd just like to endorse some of the comments made by both Tim and Gareth and Peter and Russell. I believe that this test is going to be used. We won't go into whether it's rights or wrongs of it. And My concern is a particular group of students in Victorian schools. I completed research, a PhD recently, looking at students entering secondary school with very low literacy skills. And I identified four schools that were highly successful with those students, and they had certain characteristics. And that is that those students have experienced 7 years of lack of success with learning to read. And it usually numeracy follows it as well. And unfortunately, most secondary schools, unlike our Warrnambool example and Templestowe, do not have the skills and ability to work for those kids.
So what would generally happen then, do you think?
Well, what happens is this. There's really pertinent data. About 4% of kids get into Year 7 3 to 4 years below level. So they're really struggling with reading and writing. And by Year 9, it goes to nearly 10%. So we're actually failing those kids. And 10% of Victorian students is many thousands of students. And those kids in the future, there is a shocking statistic as well, is about 70% of those in prison are functionally literate. Mm. So if you can draw up the links. The problem is we don't have the expertise in secondary schools. And it's not schools' fault to actually teach these kids the base level literacy they require. English teachers are teachers of literature, not literacy. And we do not have enough experts working in the
Well, that's only going to get worse as well, Stephen, in that we know that we're struggling for teacher numbers in particular. We're struggling for teachers in regional and rural areas. Then you add the lens of COVID over the top of that and being able to get people to come in and to fill in, you know, the teacher pool that we've been talking about. So whether or not that will have an impact on numeracy and literacy is a really important one. Looking at the standardised test results, this text here, Kirsten, saying, we consider that research that early brain development has occurred only in recent years. This is all of those extraordinary skills that we need to talk about. So adding all those other skills in life. And, you know, one area that I guess you've done a little bit of research in is looking into where agriculture fits in to teaching at school, and not just in regional and rural schools either. So in city schools, because a huge percentage of jobs in ag aren't on farms. You know, they're actually in business places, and they don't even have to be in regional or rural Victoria. It's one of the fastest growing areas in terms of education is ag tech.
Absolutely. And I'm really passionate about this because I wasn't taught anything about agriculture, but I've ended up on the land and have realised how massive agriculture is as an industry, how exciting it is. You think about food and, you know, we all eat food and, you know, there are a lot of jobs. You know, all in the supply chain. And so, look, I've brought in Bill Hamill. He's the CEO of Rural Industry Skills Training Centre, or RIST for short. It's based in Hamilton. Good morning to you, Bill.
Good morning.
Tell us what you're training your students to have when they are entering jobs in the agriculture industry. What's important when you look at future skills?
Well, I liked your comment about it's an exciting industry. So let's start with that. It's a very exciting, technologically advanced industry. Look, where we're seeing young people today, and I don't think this is any different. Agriculture shouldn't be treated any differently to any other industry, but we teach them the skills to do the job today. But one of the critical areas that we're teaching them now and looking at is the skills that they need for future work. Because I think the research is saying that most young people have 26 vocational changes in their life.
Gosh, that's jumped. I thought it was seven. When I was growing up, it was seven changes.
It's moved dramatically. And,
wow.
And now we've had the great retirement or the great resignation. It might change even further. But we're talking about, you know, the technological advancement in agriculture in particular. These students have to understand, they have to be able to communicate. So we're teaching them much, we're focusing much more on the core skills for work, communication, problem solving, leadership and working with a team. So while the skills are really important, it's very important that you set the foundations for where they might go in the future, because I always say we can teach a student to do the job today and tomorrow, but our job is really to teach them to do a job in the future, and we can't predict that. So what skills do they need to actually move forward in their career?
We've spoken a little bit about the future of work today and, as you just said, the skills that we need for that and where agriculture falls into this discussion. I do think there's still a stereotype around what agriculture means. And, you know, Kirsten, we were talking about AI and robotics and coding, and yet that actually falls into agriculture. But there is a little bit of a boxed-in image of what agriculture means. Bill, would you agree?
Absolutely. Yes, look, I've done some study, higher education study in a master's, and I'm in the process of doing a PhD if I ever can get the time to do it. But it's in that image and perception of agriculture, very much so. There's the image that, well, there's a couple of things in that. One is a lot of a stereotypical thing. If I don't come off a farm, I can't go into agriculture. Well, that's not correct. The supply chain, 75% of the actual careers in agriculture sit outside the farm gate, sit off the farm. So you don't have to have a farm to go into agriculture. The other stereotype that sits there is it's an old, old industry run by, and I'm an old man, so, you know, and I'm an aged person, so a mature age person. It's dominated by older males. Well, that's incorrect too. 50% of the workforce in agriculture are females.
I'd still say it's dominated by old men, Bill. I say this out of great respect. I said I still reckon it's dominated by old men in terms of positions of power, but there are a lot of women and young people involved too.
Yeah, no, look, there are, Rachel. There's actually, you know, you look at the leading industry bodies now, many of those have got presidents or chairmen are women. So it is moving, and I agree, but that's the stereotypical type. And technology, it's a technologically advanced industry. So we want young, bright people who are interested in gaming or interested in technology to be part of our industry.
That's interesting, and it leads perfectly into the program that we're doing on Thursday. Angus Verley will be co-hosting, and we're actually looking into the stereotypes of farming, and women fall right into that, Kirsten. I know you're really passionate about that, but also too that farmers aren't necessarily passionate about the climate or that they're all going broke or whatever it may be. All of those stereotypes, even around what they wear for whatever reason, falls back. Just finally, Bill, do you think we should be teaching elements of agriculture, and we've just heard how wide that is, at school? Let's add another list of things we should be teaching at school.
Well, it's interesting. I think there should be a connection between, you know, science and English and the curriculum. I mean, teachers are flooded every time, you know, every day they're told they should be teaching something else. But certainly I would like to see agriculture exposed more in schools as a progressive industry. And taught, you know, the subjects of agriculture, but you can link that to biology, chemistry, physics, etc. And we need technologically advanced, you know, we need technology or technicians in agriculture. So put it into science as well.
Bill Hamill, thank you so much for joining us and making sense of a complex topic.
No, thank you very much for the opportunity. Look forward to hearing more about it. Thank you.
Bill Hamill there, the CEO of RIST, based in Hamilton. And he makes that point, really, that agriculture is multidisciplinary. You know, it's a multidisciplinary thing. So you can look at it from science, from climate, from the environment, from animal health, and it falls into so many things. And city kids are missing out because they don't see it that way.
And I wonder whether that will change as well. I mean, we have seen huge numbers in tertiary education when it comes to ag tech. And surely not all of those positions are being filled by regional and rural kids, that some of that desire is coming from the city. You're shaking your head, no?
No, the ag tech is definitely coming from the city. But then you get this disconnect between how the technology is used versus how it actually works on farm, which is a whole another conversation.
Don't forget, you can always subscribe to the Conversation Hour podcast. You can go to the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts, and that way you'll never miss an episode. You can share it with your friends and family. Take care and speak to you soon.